Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, stories about identity. How do you be yourself when others assume you're something else? We talk to a transgender person about what it's like to work while transitioning, and we hear from athletes who play competitive soccer in wheelchairs. And what's behind gang violence in Fresno? Can it be curbed with an innovative program? I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. We also look at identity with our ongoing series on opioids in recovery, the story of a Kern County woman who was addicted to heroin but is now clean, and she's doing as much as she can to improve access to treatment in an area almost devoid of it.
But first, a recap of this week's news, starting with a different family of addictive drugs, amphetamines, the most notorious of which is methamphetamine. For the first time in years, the state has released county and zip code level data on meth overdoses, and one of the hardest hit areas is Kern County. Ann Sherwood from the county's mental health department says, unfortunately, that's not a surprise.
We hear from our partners that they see a lot of meth use, so calls that law enforcement go out on, when children are removed from the home, we very often hear that it's methamphetamine involved.
Statewide, fatal overdoses from opioids outnumber those from meth, but not in the San Joaquin Valley. Here, more people have been dying from meth overdoses since 2015.
Sticking with news in Kern County, Bakersfield has its own small tech scene, and Fresno-based Bitwise Industries hopes to add to the mix. The company just raised $27 million and plans to expand south. But amidst the optimism in Bakersfield, some say the tech training Bitwise offers isn't what the city needs.
I know too many unemployed software developers and computer science and engineering graduates that can't find work for that to make sense to me.
That's Kevin Mershon, a developer who works remotely from Bakersfield. He says it will take a culture shift to get businesses to pay wages that keep tech workers in Kern County. But that's a culture shift Bitwise co-founder Irma Olguin Jr. says she's willing to tackle.
When you achieve agency, it doesn't matter what the industry is, technology or otherwise, that's when you change a community. That's when you change the face of a city, and that's when you build that inclusive workforce that maybe doesn't exist in other places.
And yesterday, the Supreme Court blocked the citizenship question from being added to the 2020 census. Gabrielle Rivas is with Fresno's Economic Opportunities Commission, and she says this is a win for ensuring proper representation in the Central Valley.
It's a great thing that this question won't be on there, but at the same time, some folks are not trusting of the president already.
Rivas says the Fresno County Complete Count Committee is reminding residents that census answers are confidential.
And today, a new class of court-appointed special advocates, or CASAs, are getting sworn in. These volunteers work with foster youth in Fresno and Madera counties who have some of the most complicated circumstances and home lives. Jason Williams is the program manager for CASA of Fresno and Madera counties.
They can meet the child and really look at their environment and who they're living with and really paint a good picture for the judge so that they can make a better decision. The judges often say that the reports they get from the social worker or the attorney are very black and white, and then the CASA report adds some color.
Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
The San Joaquin Valley is riddled with opioid treatment gaps. In just Kern County, data suggests more than 4,000 people suffering from opioid use disorder lack access to effective treatment. As part of my ongoing series, In Recovery, I'm going to tell you about one Kern County woman who's made it her mission to connect her community to care. Earlier this spring, a few dozen people sat in a Bakersfield conference room in front of a table piled high with nondescript white boxes, each one about the size of a shoebox. Among those was Heather Menzel, who couldn't wait to grab as many as possible from the man sitting behind the table.
So how many do you guys want?
As many as we can all collectively get together.
Inside each one is a dozen smaller boxes of naloxone, the drug that can stop an opioid overdose cold.
So there's 48 in here.
All together?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
This county and state-sponsored event provides training and free naloxone kits to community members all around Kern County. Menzel has nabbed about 60 kits to bring back to Lake Isabella, where she lives in the isolated Kern River Valley, about 40 miles outside Bakersfield.
For, I would say, regular everyday problems, there's not a lot of services, let alone a lot of services for people that have substance use disorders or alcoholism or mental health disorders.
This event is part of the state's naloxone distribution program, which has dispersed $16 million worth of the drug throughout California. In the Kern River Valley, Menzel and her colleagues say they know of at least three times the drug has been used. Critics say it enables drug use, but the medical community agrees it saves lives. Menzel says she's handed them out to users, providers, and also everyday people looking out for each other.
I want to cry just thinking about a couple of the people that I've given one to. They just feel like they're doing something when they feel so helpless in saving the life of their loved one.
4 years ago, Menzel was one of those people in need of help. But today, she's sober. The petite 36-year-old with bright eyes and a Hello Kitty tattoo on her left arm is a full-time student, full-time waitress, and full-time mom to a 4-year-old named Isabella Sunshine.
I'm going to turn my window down, Mama.
Okay, baby. Here, let me take your temperatures off. Okay, I got you signed up for recital pictures tomorrow.
It's Menzel's busiest night of the week, and she hustles around the valley in her heavy-duty Ford Excursion.
Mommy!
First stop, drop Bella off at dance class. On her way to the door, Bella picks up something from the parking lot and goes to put it in her mouth.
No, don't touch it. That's disgusting.
I'll put it in my shoe.
No, I don't want that in your shoe. Gross.
While Bella's in class, Menzel and I sit down at a picnic table where she tells me her daughter was the turning point in her life, the thing that helped her turn her back on drugs for good. Menzel says she first used meth when she was just 12 or 13.
Before you know it, you know, you wake up and you're 18 and you haven't graduated high school, and all of a sudden you're not just a partier, you realize you're a drug addict, you know?
In her 20s, she says she switched from meth to heroin.
And I did heroin all the way up until I got pregnant with my first child at the age of 32, and that's when I got sober.
But she didn't just flip a switch. She had gotten into a medication-assisted treatment program where she got methadone every day, but the clinic was an hour away in Bakersfield.
But I was still homeless, in an abusive relationship, living in a garage. You know, I didn't have any money to get down there every day. When you can't get down there every day, then they eventually kicked me off, even though I was pregnant. They told me I was too much of a liability and that they couldn't help me anymore.
One night, it hit her what a bad spot she was in.
And I just remember crying out to God. I hadn't prayed in years, like the most earnest prayer I've ever prayed in my whole entire life.
She says around 4 a.m., the phone started ringing and ringing and ringing. Finally, she picked it up. It was her mother.
I'm going to start crying when I tell this part of the story.
They had been estranged for years, ever since Menzel had pawned her mother's wedding rings to feed her habit.
She said, they're going to let you back on treatment, and I'm going to drive you down there myself every day, and you're not going to lose this baby. And she did.
Those first few weeks were hard. But eventually, Menzel moved back in with her mom and stepdad. She had Bella, and earlier this year, she even finished methadone for good. Now she's helping take care of her niece, Jordan Mendoza, who adores Bella.
Did you have fun dancing? Dancing, dancing.
The 27-year-old is recovering from meth abuse, and she says Menzel was there for her when Mendoza got out of prison a few weeks ago. She had served 10 months on felony burglary charges.
Because she's the best positive influence that I have. She's my best friend, you know what I mean? She comes home from work, and I'm like, woo, my friend's home, you know?
Positive influences are important in the Kern River Valley. This region of only 10,000 people consistently reports one of the highest rates of fatal opioid overdoses in the county, mostly from heroin, which also sends dozens of people to hospitals and emergency rooms each year. And of the county's 47 prescribers waivered to offer treatment medication, zero work in the Kern River Valley. Only one clinic and one independent therapist offer outpatient substance abuse counseling. The county, however, is working to improve those numbers, and the local hospital has a grant to expand access to substance abuse care. A new community action network is also doing its own grassroots work.
Oh, yeah, we probably got to go right now. What time is it?
5:13.
Okay.
And around a year ago, Heather Menzel helped establish a new recovery group.
Are we supposed to get anybody else? Is that it?
After Bella's dance class, Menzel shuttles friends over to Faith Community Church in Woburn Heights. It's their local chapter of the 12-step program Celebrate Recovery, where I love you is a normal part of conversation.
Salvation, grace, mercy, all that, God has given it to you and it's unlimited. But we still have to do the footwork. We have to do our part.
Before separating into support groups, the pastor delivers a sermon to around 40 enrapt people. Two tell me it's the best recovery group they've ever joined.
Guys, thank you. Seriously, we're going to have we always close with the serenity prayer.
One of the organizers is Ron Hagler, who's recovering from meth and alcohol abuse. He went to high school with Menzel, and he attributes a lot of this positive momentum to her.
She makes time to help the next person. She engages and she recruits and she brings people to the table. She's got a heart of gold, and it's purely out of wanting to see the next person have help.
When she's not out and about, Menzel is studying to get a bachelor's degree in addiction counseling. Her hope that a medication-assisted treatment clinic offering methadone or buprenorphine will someday come to the Kern River Valley.
This is my home and this is my community, and now that I see all the beautiful things here, I want to be a part of that, and I want to use my degree locally to help our community. That's like the sole purpose.
And maybe someday, hundreds of boxes of naloxone won't be necessary. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
June is Pride Month, and today we're going to look at the workplace. Nationally, about 1 in 4 transgender people say they've lost a job because of biases against them. Far more, about 3/4, say they've experienced some form of discrimination. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez has this story about why it's difficult for some transgender people in the Valley to find jobs.
Michaela Argon picks up a tube of peach-colored foundation, squeezes out the liquid on a makeup sponge, and starts brushing it on in front of a mirror.
This is what my ritual would be when I get home from a day being masculine me and working to fix the computer issues of the day.
Argon works in tech and identifies as non-binary. That means you're not exclusively masculine or feminine.
My pronouns are they, them. Okay, I go by they, them pronouns primarily because it feels the most comfortable in my situation of presenting both masculine and feminine.
And Argon is taking hormones to look more feminine. Argon says in the past, being non-binary has not been easy when it comes to finding a job.
I got to a final interview with a local company that I really thought was interesting and I could see myself developing my career with. And it was about that same time that I got a notification in my email that said my LinkedIn profile had been viewed 26 times.
Argon says the people viewing the profile were recruiters from the company. Argon looked feminine in the profile picture, but in the interviews, Argon was dressed masculine.
When I went into the interview, I just felt that the conversations and the tone, it felt a little different. I could be wrong, but I was being kind of observant, and that's how I felt.
Dana Galanti, the transgender program coordinator at the Source LGBTQ Plus Center in Visalia, says many people who are transitioning in the Valley have similar experiences.
Most trans people are afraid to even go start looking for a job because, especially around here, because they know, you know, there's a pretty high percentage that are not going to be accepting of who they are. And who they are and how they look and, you know, what their names are.
She says some companies in bigger cities like Los Angeles or San Francisco are more open about hiring transgender people.
The specific word, we are safe, we are trans friendly, that takes away a whole level of fear for these kids and adults. So, yeah, I think it makes a big difference.
But in more rural areas, businesses might be hesitant to do that because of the potential backlash from consumers. Galanti says she knows some transgender people who have moved out of the Valley because it's easier to find jobs. And at least one transgender woman in Fresno has filed a workplace discrimination lawsuit.
My mental health is just kind of deteriorating.
That's Maddie Wade. She filed a lawsuit against Starbucks and her former store manager, Dustin Guthrie, in May. The lawsuit states that after about a year of working at the Herndon and Milburn Starbucks, Wade told Guthrie and her coworkers she was transitioning into a woman. She asked people to call her Maddie and use she, her pronouns. Wade says everyone but Guthrie respected that.
He continued to call me Matt, and dude and bro, and just never, not even once, called me Maddie or her or anything like that.
Wade says Guthrie told her he had a hard time wrapping his head around her transition. About a month later, Wade says Guthrie started cutting her hours and stopped training her to be a store manager. She says he also tried to pressure her to step down from her supervisor position. And she says she tried talking to him about it multiple times.
During those conversations, he kind of just brushed off my concerns and nothing ever changed. So eventually I asked for a transfer to another location.
Wade claims she was discriminated against by Guthrie because she was transgender. She says she tried to talk to the district manager and her new store manager, but nothing was done.
From there on, I realized that nobody was taking it seriously at all. And shortly thereafter, I resigned from my position.
Arnold Peter, Wade's attorney, says Starbucks is known for its progressive policies that protect its transgender employees.
Particularly in this case, it's really ironic and unfortunate that an otherwise extremely progressive employer, such as Starbucks, wasn't able to live up to not only their own policies and procedures, but, just generally individuals' rights to express their gender.
This month, a judge issued a tentative ruling saying Starbucks did not intentionally discriminate against Wade because of her gender. But at a hearing, Peter made a counterargument, and the judge decided to review the evidence again.
And there's no state or federal case that specifically addresses the question in this case, which is, does intentional misgendering constitute harassment and discrimination under the employment laws?
Starbucks spokesperson Reggie Borges says the company has a long history of supporting the LGBTQ community. He says the company agrees that intentional misgendering is a form of discrimination, but he says there's no proof that Guthrie discriminated against or harassed Wade. Guthrie and his lawyer did not respond to a request for comment. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
Fresno is one step closer to adopting a new program that uses mentoring, behavioral therapy, and life skills training to curb gun violence in the city. Council members voted last week to allocate $200,000 to fund Advance Peace. Now, local leaders and Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer have 90 days to submit a proposal detailing how the money will be used, and the council will then vote on it. Moderator Kathleen Schock talks to council members Miguel Arias and Gary Bredefeld, as well as community organizer Aaron Foster, about their takes on the program.
So, Aaron Foster, I want to start with you. Through your work with Faith in the Valley, you have been engaged in the fight to mitigate gun violence in Fresno for a long time. And this is a very personal topic for you, based upon your experience. I'd love for you to share briefly your story and how that has informed your decision to advocate on behalf of Advance Peace.
Well, I've been working for Faith in the Valley for a short year. It'll be a year. It was a year in March. So I started doing the work 6 years ago. My son got killed on Labor Day weekend, and he was a gang member. But 2 years ago, my daughter got killed Labor Day weekend as well, and she was the furthest thing from a gang member you ever met. So with her innocence, it made me work even harder. So then I went to Chicago to try to figure out something besides what was going on in Fresno. And I ran into Devon Bogan, and he explained to me the components of Advanced Peace. So I started implementing it in Fresno. And the main component is identifying the shooter and the person most at risk of being shot. I went from door to door because I knew shooters and asked for a favor. And the reason why they said yes, because I tore into the heartstrings of the people that were committing these crimes and asked them, which one of you guys are ready to bury your babies? If it happened to me once, I mean twice, it can happen to you once. So my daughter, the thing that keeps me motivated every day, she was an activist. She worked with Take a Stand. She was the youth ambassador. And she had been working with them since she was 13 years old. So this is my way of keeping that fire lit and preventing this from happening from other innocent people, as well as changing the mindsets of violent criminals who want to change their life. So the narrative says that we pay gang members not to engage, but anyone that knows a gang member knows that for that minimal amount of money, they will never disengage. So if we change the language just a little and said this is to support violent people into making a transition to functional adults and citizens, then it won't be so hard to swallow.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm going to shift now to Councilmember Bredefeld, who's joining us by phone. You have been a vocal opponent of advanced peace. Tell us a little bit about why you are in such opposition to this initiative.
Well, first of all, let me say, I've talked with Mr. Foster on several occasions. I have great admiration for what he's trying to do, and my heart breaks for his loss. So it's unspeakable tragedy. I just feel, in terms of my opposition to this, that this is not what taxpayer money ought to be used for. If it's privately funded and people want to invest in that program, that's fine. But for me, one, I don't think taxpayer money ought to be used for that. And two, just on the concept of it, that even in the 6 or 7 months when people who either are engaged in crime, prospectively might be engaged in crime, shouldn't be getting stipends from taxpayers as a way of also continuing not to be in trouble. I mean, this can go in a lot of different directions, from people who could potentially violate the law, and they could justify stipends and other things. It's just not the way you solve the crime problem. You solve the crime problem by having strict, tough criminal laws, which we don't have. They've been neutered. They've been weakened. And you have people pay serious consequences for criminal behavior, which doesn't happen. It used to happen when we had three strikes. People who were criminals and chronic criminals were aware of when their third strike was coming up because they knew they were going to be put away. There were real penalties at that point. And historically, we saw the data, crime went down. As soon as that changed, crime has gone up in terms of the weakening of criminal laws with Prop 47, Prop 57, AB 109, releasing criminals. What used to be a felony is now a misdemeanor. What's a misdemeanor is now an infraction.
Right. I appreciate all this background, but I do want to keep the conversation focused on advanced peace. So just to provide a bit of clarity on your position, obviously you are in opposition of using taxpayer funds for the initiative. But I wonder, to what extent is the stipend itself part of why you are opposed to this idea?
Both of them. One, it's a misuse of taxpayer money. Some would argue it's a gift of taxpayer money. But I don't think you get the kind of behavior you want because you give somebody a $500 stipend wherever it goes, wherever it comes from. Whether it's private money or public money, I don't think this program will work or has worked. And the feedback I've gotten from where it's been initiated, from gang task force folks as well as district attorneys, it doesn't work. There isn't the accountability. It's not going to work just on its face. I mean, it just doesn't make even any sense.
Well, but there are others who say that it is working. But I'll get back to you on this point in just a minute. But I want to bring in Councilmember Miguel Arias. So tell us a little bit about sort of where we stand today in terms of this process. You know, nobody has a crystal ball. We don't know what kind of recommendations are going to be presented to the council in 90 days. But I'm wondering, from where you sit, do you see this as a significant shift in how the city of Fresno goes about thinking about addressing gun violence?
It's a dramatic shift. And the reason why it's dramatic is we currently have no other alternative. Just to be clear about the problem in the city of Fresno, about 75% of the violent crimes and murders are related to gun violence. We currently have 138 suspected shooters in the city of Fresno identified by the police chief of Fresno that have never been arrested, prosecuted, or convicted. Those are the targets of this intervention program, is folks who have not been arrested by the police chief or prosecuted by the district attorney. These are individuals who commit, have been suspected of a crime, but nobody's willing to be a witness, that continue to be an exposure and a threat to the community. And the fact is, there is no alternative. For the last decade, the police department has not had an intervention program that addresses this particular group of individuals or gun violence in general. Historically, we did have that. We used to have the mayor's gang prevention program. We used to fund ceasefire. All those things went away and nothing was put in place of them. That's why we saw in 2017, the summer of 17, 20 straight days of shootings where people were literally shooting each other in our churches. And each time the spree of violence occurs in our city, It is people like Aaron Foster that are called on by the police department. It is pastors, community leaders who are asked to help reduce the violence, and they have done so successfully in reaction to a significant tragedy. Just this weekend, we had three shootings, including a 10-month-old. And each time it gets out of control, the police chief calls on the community to help reduce it and get control of it. Our position as a council is, let's formalize that relationship. And, you know, we can argue about the specifics of the strategy or the eventual intervention program, but the fact is we need to have a formal intervention program for the suspected shooters that are a significant threat to our community. And if the police chief or the district attorney don't support this model, then have them come up with an alternative. But we need an alternative.
So I'm glad you brought up some of the other initiatives that the city has engaged in the past. You know, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer has indicated his support for advanced peace, at least in theory, although he has some concerns about using taxpayer dollars to fund the initiative. But he also has pointed to other initiatives like the couple that you mentioned as being opportunities to address violence and make the streets safer. Aaron Foster, I'm curious from your perspective, do you think that there is something unique about advanced peace that could make a significant difference in the area, or do you think there's other ways that we could go about addressing this issue other than, you know, this idea? And I understand that advanced peace is more than stipends, but that certainly is at the center of the controversy.
Yes, I think that the thing with advanced peace is that we're using it already. So if you look at the stats in Fresno, the day my daughter died, we went 45 days without one gunshot because I went door to door asking for the favor and tearing into the heartstrings of the shooters. We sustained 48% decrease in gun violence that year, 53% this year. So with the help of the police and ShotSpotter, who don't want to take nothing away from them, but I'm saying the community had a big push in the reduction of this gun violence. So I think that the community should be the one that decide what works, because this initiative that we took to reduce the gun violence has been effective. It's like I always use food analogies. So you can tell me how bad cornbread is for you, but you can't tell me the ingredients that make it taste good. So this is the same thing. I can tell you what it takes, because even 11 months ago, I talked to Captain Salazar and Lieutenant Ramsey and said, these young men are getting restless. We have to find something for them to do. And then in waiting, we have these outbreaks and gun violence in other parts of the city. Because in January, ShotSpotter, we had three drive-by shootings in Southwest Fresno. And with the help of ShotSpotter, all three people got caught. So now I'm spilling over to other areas of Fresno. But it's the same culprits that are committing this violence. So we have to grab them. The person that shot my daughter hasn't been arrested. He's still free, able to shoot people. So possibly, if he got into this program, we can deter him. But if this is not an asylum, if evidence is gathered and he can be convicted of this crime, they'll take him right out of this program and send him away. But in the meantime, we need to have him doing something besides committing violent acts.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking with Fresno City Council members Gary Bredefeld and Miguel Arias, along with Aaron Foster of Faith in the Valley Fresno, about the vote last week allocating $200,000 to develop a plan to roll out advanced peace and perhaps other initiatives to curb gun violence and help keep the streets of Fresno a bit safer. So, Councilmember Bredefeld, I'd like to come back to you. You spoke about sentencing laws already, but another central part of your position in opposition of advanced peace is to invest money into increasing the police presence in Fresno. You know, some of your critics have said that hasn't worked in the past. Why do you think it would work now?
We don't have enough police to do the enforcement that we need. We need to hire more police officers. We need to hire more for homeless task force officers. Our Jerry Dyer said we needed to quadruple that task force. We need to hire 911 dispatchers. And this notion that this is outdated, it's not outdated, the notion of arresting people who commit crimes. What the problem is, and you mentioned let's stay focused. I mentioned the weakening of criminal laws. That is the heart of what the problem is. The greatest crime deterrent, the greatest way to avoid crime is to make people accountable for their crimes. And that doesn't happen in this state.
But there is an argument that education and access to economic resources is also a deterrent to crime.
Absolutely. And I'm in complete agreement. We don't disagree on that. And we don't disagree on the fact that providing every opportunity for at-risk youth ought to be provided. I'm a strong proponent of services for at-risk youth. I'm a strong proponent for anybody who's at risk to help them. But once they cross the line into crime, then they need to have penalties and there needs to be accountability. And that's what's lacking. There is no accountability. And my colleague said there's no other alternatives. There's 138 suspected shooters never been arrested. Well, you don't provide them a stipend and that's going to prevent them from shooting somebody. We need to have real law enforcement and real laws to deal with people who commit crimes. That doesn't happen. And what's happened now, you know, in terms of people who are out on the street, you used to be able to force people to make a choice. You either get help with your drug problem or you go to jail. Well, now that we've weakened all the laws through 47 and 57, they're now out on the street. And that's what's happening in our city. So to ignore it, to act like, well, we've tried everything. No, we haven't tried everything. What we've done is we've weakened the laws and there's no accountability. That's why there's crime.
There is a philosophical shift taking place against seeing drug abuse as a crime and seeing it as a disease. But that's a topic for another conversation.
Yeah,
Aaron Foster, you had something you wanted to say.
I just don't think that the laws are weakening for murder. Murder is a life sentence, no matter what. So the laws aren't being weakened for those acts, and people still commit them every day. So
they are being weakened because you can now be an accessory to a murder and you don't get charged for being an accessory anymore. They've even weakened that. You actually have to be the one who pulls the trigger. You can
absolutely
be there and not even be charged for it. So they have been weakened. All of these laws have been weakened. To act like they haven't been weakened is to ignore reality.
So reality is if I get a gun and I shoot somebody and I get convicted of that, that law hasn't changed. So that's what I'm speaking into.
Yeah,
I'm not
true.
Speaking into the accessories. I'm speaking into the people that actually commit these crimes. They get punished to the full extent of the law. And that hasn't been a deterrent in the least. People are still dying.
Well, we would differ on whether or not they are prosecuted to the full extent of the law or that they serve their maximum sentences, because most people are not serving maximum sentences and are getting off for quote-unquote good behavior, and that's why we have a revolving jail and prison system.
You know, I would agree with the council member that a stipend is not going to deter anybody from committing a crime. And the unfortunate part of this conversation around gun violence is that this debate has been reduced to a stipend, when we know that the full program and the totality of prevention is not related to a stipend that's proposed to be paid for by private sector funds. It has been reduced to that on talk radio, on some of the social media outlets. But the fact remains that more officers doesn't equate to lower crime. Today, we have less officers per residence than we did a decade ago. And yet crime has been reducing for a decade. Now, we can discuss what kinds of crimes have increased, from petty theft related to the methamphetamine epidemic or things of that nature. But we cannot simply afford to continue down the path of incarcerating everyone. That's, you know, we tried that for 30 years and the state almost went bankrupt. We as a city cannot afford to, in this budget alone, cannot afford to add 50 more officers. You know, and we can't even afford to add two, according to the mayor of Fresno, much less 50 or the 90 more that the police chief believes he needs.
So, if I can interrupt you, what are the economics as you see them in terms of advanced peace versus bringing in more officers?
The economics are this. It costs us an estimated $1 million to investigate a shooting, $1.7 million to prosecute a shooting. It's far cheaper. We're currently spending about $500,000 in ShotSpotter to identify a shooting after it occurred. For me, it is sensible to say, let's spend $200,000 in a prevention program so we can reduce the costs at the back end. Now, can we argue about the components of the program? Of course. We're a policy-making body, and for some, it's more controversial than it is for others. But it is cost prohibitive to simply focus on the reaction and the enforcement after the fact. And even if we did, it still does not address the fact that there's 138 suspected shooters that have never been arrested, prosecuted, or convicted. we have to deal with that reality because, quite frankly, personally, I am frustrated that every time I turn around, we're setting up a scholarship fund for a victim of a shooting. We're setting up, you know, a memorial for a victim of a shooting. We're asking pastors and communities to show up in a press conference and ask for a ceasefire. We are always in the reactive mode of trying to prevent these innocent victims, and it hasn't worked.
So, Councilmember Bredefeld, I'd love for you to weigh in on this a bit. The way you were framing the conversation, it is very much a post-crime approach and using law enforcement using the judicial system as a form of deterrent to committing a crime. Whereas I would argue that Advanced Peace is taking a proactive approach, keeping people from engaging in gang activities. Do you feel like there is room for a proactive approach to addressing this issue?
Absolutely. I just don't think taxpayer money should be used for providing stipends to people who may or may not commit crimes or have committed crimes in the past. You want to have people work with gang members? Absolutely. I don't have any problem with that. The change that comes from people who engage in criminal behavior is one where they have a change of heart and they recognize this is not a life that I want to be involved in, and it's not going to be changed with a $500 a month stipend. It gets changed with jobs, and it gets changed with enforcement and accountability. And that's the only way you really change people who are involved in criminal activity.
So I think we found some common ground. Aaron Foster, you're nodding.
And I definitely agree with it. And that's the thing that this program unwraps. It's not everyone doesn't want to leave that lifestyle, but for the people that do, we want to give them some type of assistance in making the transition. So we totally agree on that thing.
And a big portion of this program and any program that the council would consider for approval is to train these individuals and employ them in good paying jobs so that they don't have to rely on a few hundred dollars to engage in a shooting to be able to provide for themselves. And that's, you know, to the point of Councilmember Chavez when he said there's nothing better than a job to prevent crime.
Right. And then when we break down that none of the taxpayers dollars go to the individuals enrolled.
So we're talking about creating an enormous shift in a city in which there are several factors that contribute to violence and gang activities. Advanced Peace is a program that has had some results in some communities. In others, it has just gotten off the ground, and we'll see whether or not it is successful. But my point is that there is an element of risk associated with this. There is no magic bullet. We do not know whether or not it's going to work. Councilmember Bredefeld, I'm wondering if the past experiences of other communities have at all shaped your thinking around this initiative.
You mean where this program has been in place?
Is that
what you're referring?
Yes.
Well, the feedback that I've gotten from other places is that it has not been effective, that people who have run this program haven't worked with law enforcement, and they just simply don't feel that it's effective. And so that's the feedback that I've received. I haven't seen one professional study done, and I mean professional. I'm not talking about anecdotal data. Professional study that's done that's proven the effectiveness of this program. There isn't one. Councilmember Arias has brought in some information that's, you know, been more anecdotal, and that's fine. That has value. But there's a difference between a professional study being done and people espousing a point of view like we're all doing right now. And there hasn't been any validated study done in a professional manner that shows that this program works.
You know, Councilmember Bredefeld, and I would agree with you on that there hasn't been, you know, a study completed by the research body of, you know, Berkeley or USC on this program that I'm aware of. But at the same time, this budget that we're about to adopt tomorrow includes $14 million more for the police department. And we didn't consider any research study to determine that we needed to add $14 million. It also includes a 10% salary raise for our police officers. We didn't engage in a conversation about a research study to determine that our officers deserve a salary increase. So every year when we debate adding more police officers, bike officers to the Tower District or the Shaw Corridor, none of those things are ever considered in the backdrop of is there research to determine or to support the fact that these additional officers would reduce crime. What we have done, and which I do believe is the right thing to do, is we got to do a little bit of everything. I compare this to the dropout crisis. We know there isn't a silver bullet. to address a dropout problem in any city, you have to do a little bit of a lot of things. And in my view, we have historically invested a lot in public safety reacting to crimes that are being committed. The economy has been the biggest driver of lowering and reducing crime in the city of Fresno. A lower unemployment rate means less crime being committed. But we still have to do something around the prevention of gun violence in our city. And absent of regulating the Second Amendment, which would be far more controversial in our community, we have to figure out how to deal with the gun violence in our streets.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but unfortunately, we have to wrap up this conversation. Miguel Arias, Aaron Foster, Gary Bredefeld, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Members of Fresno's wheelchair-powered soccer team, the Central Valley Ghost Riders, have just returned from this year's national tournament in Indiana. Team members Buddy Elias and Alex Voss and head coach Frank Cornell spoke with FM 89's news director Alice Daniel about their third-place win in their division and the teamwork required to hit and control the ball using wheelchairs.
First of all, congratulations on your third place win. That's out of 11 teams from all over the United States. Now, the motorized wheelchairs have a rigid steel guard attached to the front, which you use to hit and move the ball. And the skill it takes to maneuver the wheelchair as if it's a pinball lever moving the ball around looks incredibly difficult. Buddy, there's nothing easy about this, is there?
No. I would say the learning curve to control the chair itself is fairly quick, but no, there is nothing easy about hitting the ball and the direction and the angles.
And Coach Frank Cornell, you agree that there's nothing easy about this, but then...
When they first get in the chair, they can learn to drive the chair relatively quickly, but control it in a way that we can play soccer is entirely different. That takes years sometimes.
And it's definitely a sport that requires teamwork. Tell us how you operate as a team and what's the dynamic on the field, or I guess we'll say the court because it's indoors.
Right.
Buddy or Alex, do you want to chime in here?
The team is, you know, you have to have the good rotations and you have to be in constant communication so everybody understands what you're doing. Because in power soccer, there's a rule where two of the same team can't be on the ball with a defender within 3 meters. So we have to be in constant communication of who's going to defend the ball, who's moving around, and just try and stay away from each other so we don't get the penalty.
So do you huddle together before the game and map out a plan?
Huddle together before the game at halftime, and sometimes if the ball goes, you know, all the way away and the ref have to go chase it down, we'll on the court go talk to each other, talk about how the game's going and talk about what changes might need to happen.
Yeah, it's much like rugby where the coach can't call a timeout and so the game continues. So your captains on your team and are really important because they control what's going on. Of course, I'm on the sidelines yelling and stuff. But,
yes.
Yelling and screaming like any good coach worth his or her salt.
Kind of, yeah.
Definitely.
And, Buddy, you're the oldest player on the team. Before you
thanks
started,
for pointing that out,
you're
by
welcome.
The way.
I know you wanted me to. Before you started playing for this team 2 years ago, you were a national snowboarding champion in adaptive sports. How would you compare these two sports?
Oh, there's no comparison. I cried after the first game after this tournament. It's the most emotional, one of the most hardest thing I've ever had to do. It blows any of the action sports that I've done. And it's not so much just the trying to compare the two, but when you're dealing with a team and you have three other individuals that are counting on your play, that makes a big difference. When you're on an individual sport, when you fall down and make a mistake, it's nobody else's downfall from that, just your own.
So
absolutely.
So it's the teamwork?
It's a team effort, absolutely.
And, Buddy, both of your legs were amputated. I read a quote where you said, as weird as this sounds, this is the best thing that's happened to me.
Well, yeah, I'm healthy. I get to play with a team like this. I'm still alive. I don't have any problems at this point. And if I didn't quit doing what took my legs, I wouldn't be here today.
And what was that?
It's an allergic reaction to cigarette nicotine called Berger's disease.
Alex, You'll be a senior in high school next year. You're the goalie for the team, and you've been playing for 6 years. So what was the tournament like for you?
This tournament wasn't the first year that I have gone to this one. This was our second year as a team, and I went the year before. So I was much more excited for this year since I had been and see just how big of an event this is. It's the national tournament, which is this year there were 39 teams that went to this tournament and 11 in our conference, as you said earlier. And it was just amazing to see all the chairs there in this one facility, and it was just amazing.
And you said you've never played sports before. What was it like to start out with this competitive soccer team?
It was the first day when I went out there, we saw all the chairs banging together. And this was before the real taking over of the chairs that we have now, which are the specially designed for this sport. So it was a lot of just the everyday chairs. And as soon as I saw that first practice is when I fell in love and was immediately knew that this was going to be what I wanted to do.
And Frank, you started coaching the team when it started in 2009.
That's correct.
And at that point, you were basically creating wheelchairs that would work for this.
Yeah, we had to use the regular runaround chairs, the chairs they lived in day in and day out. And so it was a lot of work putting guards on and trying to reprogram these chairs to do things that they weren't really meant to do.
You said you put crates on the front?
Yeah, milk crates and we do plastic guards, milk crates, you name it, I've tried it. I mean, we tried to put everything on. The advent of the Strike Force wheelchair that's made for soccer, for power soccer, has changed the game significantly. And I think, all in all, it equalizes the playing field for everyone. You have fast chairs or quick chairs, I should say, because they're limited in forward speed. But they're incredibly maneuverable. It's like the difference between a Volkswagen and a Ferrari. I mean, they're really, really amazing. And so it makes it more of a passing game instead of more of a, controlling the ball game, and makes it a lot more exciting.
And Alex, you are different from a lot of your team members in that
Yes.
instead of using your hand to control the wheelchair, you use your foot.
Well, for me, it's my everyday. Everybody else, they control their chair with their hand. For me, I control it with my foot since I can't use my hands like everybody else. So I use my foot. So when everybody else looks at me and is like, oh, how do you do that? My response is like, I don't know. How do you control it with your hand?
Exactly. It's a different perspective.
For me, it doesn't seem as special as everybody makes it out to be.
It's what you're used to.
Right.
And it's special. It really is. I couldn't imagine trying to control one of these animals. And the chair is an animal. It'll rip you right out of the seat with my foot. So what he does is very, very special.
Well, talk about that a little bit more. What's it like to be in this highly competitive sport? And you've got these wheelchairs going really fast, I would imagine. Watching it from afar on a video, it almost looks like a pinball game.
The video doesn't do it justice.
No, I doubt it does.
It's extremely quick.
Yeah, things happen really quick on the court. And you got to be in the right spot at the right time, or you'll miss the opportunity. And missed opportunities could also officially, ultimately cost you a game.
And so how do you make sure that you stay in your wheelchair, Alex?
Well, I just have a simple seatbelt just over my lap. And for me, that's enough because I am able to, I lean back in my chair, make sure I'm all the way back against the thing. And I'm used to it, and I'm in a power chair every day. So I'm used to being able to control my balance and my body and able to stay in the chair.
But it takes some skill. It takes some getting used to.
Yes. When I first got into that Strike Force chair, it was such a big difference from my regular chair. It's very sensitive. On the joystick, you barely touch it. You've done a 180 already.
It's a little bit dangerous, too, because as a coach, I've been hit a number of times, and if you someone doesn't turn it off and you're removing someone out of the chair and the joystick just gets touched, it spins halfway around, and that guard is hard, and it hits you in the ankles or breaks your legs. So you have to be really careful. Yeah.
And so, Frank, you've been coaching for 10 years. Tell me, what is it like to coach this team?
It's a blessing for me, to be honest with you. I get way more out of it than I put into it, and I put a lot into it. But the athletes that we have are true athletes, and it's amazing to me to teach them the guts of the game, the strategies, and and the tactics,
the little maneuvers to get the ball around this person, to be able to see that from a different position that we can't while we're on the court playing.
Yeah, it's really hard and for them to see that. And when they get it, it's really amazing.
Daniel is really good at observing the court and making an adjustment on the court and throwing the guy. He'll call my name. Everybody will run toward me, and he'll shoot it over to Rodrigo over on the far right wing, and Rod will take it downtown.
Daniel Cornejo, our center, he won Most Valuable Player of the tournament. So that's how good players we've got.
The team is taking this very seriously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so do I.
Yeah. Yes.
If you're not late to practice or you don't show up without calling, it's not good for you.
No.
No.
What's next for the team?
What we're going to do is we're going to try and win all our games. We only lost one game in this tournament. This last tournament.
It was the most important game, but
unfortunately.
Still.
But anyway, we're looking forward to next year, and I'm fairly confident that I've got a team that can win this thing.
We practice, I'd like to mention too, we practice at St. Anthony's Gymnasium. We practice usually on a Saturday from 12 to 3.
Every Saturday?
It just
during
depends.
During the season.
Yeah, during the season. But we definitely welcome new players. We definitely welcome volunteers. When we're practicing, a volunteer on the sideline makes us get twice as much practice in. If we're having to chase the ball down, our practice gets cut in half.
Yeah.
Well, Frank, Buddy, and Alex, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
And now it's time for the weekend. We're going to introduce you to an annual festival, the Organic Stone Fruit Jubilee, that's equal parts a harvest celebration and a nod to the farmers who tend the trees. It takes place tomorrow, June 29th, at the Mokichi Okada Association's Oasis Garden in Clovis. To learn more, I spoke to Mike and Nori Naylor. They grow apricots, nectarines, peaches, and plums on their organic farm in Dinuba. Here's how Nori describes the Jubilee.
This is an event that was started actually 12 years ago by a group of farmers, and they decided they wanted to have an event that would promote locally grown produce, and especially or particularly stone fruit. They wanted to be able to have people meet the farmers, because at that time, farmers markets weren't really the thing like they are now. Have a chance to taste the best, juiciest, ripest fruit possible, because often you cannot find that anywhere else than directly from the farmer. And so it was just an idea to just kind of help a community develop in this area, because there is so much organic stone fruit, or not a lot of organic, but there's a lot of stone fruit grown in this area.
To experience all of those things, tasting and sort of understanding where our fruit comes from, can you talk about a little bit about what is slated for Saturday's Jubilee itself? Like, what are the, I guess, activities that are planned and things like that?
Well, it's called a Jubilee for a reason. There are numerous activities for all ages. The reason that we're involved is because we love seeing people taste the ripe fruit and the flavor of the fruit. But there are kids' activities, there's pony rides, there's a craft area for children, there are food booths, there are vendors, and so it's just an all-around event to build community.
And Mike, I understand you're speaking at it, right? Can you give us a bit of a preview on what you'll be talking about?
I'll be talking about what it's like to retire from farming and the idiosyncrasies that go with that, because it's not as easy as we think it is, and what it's like to not have the next generation farming for you.
Getting back to the fruit, you know, there's a wide variety. Like, what always comes to my mind is like peaches, but there's also plums and cherries. And what is, I guess, if you're picking one to eat, I'm really curious, what's your favorite? Mike, well, I'll start with you.
Peaches, of course. I love peaches. There are so many different varieties and so many different flavors. So it's like the wine of fruit.
What about you, Nori?
Well, yes, the variety. I particularly like white peaches. I like the Babcock variety, which we unfortunately will not have at the event because it's not ready yet. But I like it when it's crunchy because it brings back memories of my grandparents' farm because they grew that variety of peach.
The Organic Stone Fruit Jubilee is tomorrow evening starting at 5 p.m. in Clovis at the Mokichi Okada Association's Oasis Garden. You can find tickets and more information online.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Carrie Klein, Alice Daniel,
Monica Velez, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.